I'm very pleased to be here to be able to speak about lessons learned from the global financial meltdown. My comments today are going to focus on financial myths and the role that financial myths have played in the various financial problems over the last 3 years. So what do I mean by financial myths? Well, financial myths are an assumption by many investors that recent trends and historical data are likely to continue and are not likely to be substantially reversed. This means that unlikely outcomes are largely ignored, so that investors and investor behavior does not incorporate the potential that unlikely outcomes could still nonetheless occur. So I'm going to go through two examples from recent history of financial myths and the role that they played. The first is looking at the Japanese real estate market. I first became exposed to this while I was an economist here at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and I was looking at problems in New England real estate markets in the late 1980s. As many of you know who have lived in New England, real estate prices dropped quite dramatically during the late 1980s for both commercial and residential real estate. Interestingly, there were a variety of both academics and government officials from Japan who wanted to know why it was that we hadn't seen the crisis coming and why we hadn't reacted in a more effective way. It was an interesting question to ask, as at that time, as you can see in Figure 1, Japanese real estate prices had gone up quite substantially. When I inquired with these academics and government officials about whether it was possible that Japanese prices could reverse themselves, I was always assured that they would not be reversed because Japan is an island, and since it's an island, there were limited building lots, and as a result, it was very unlikely that prices would be reversed. Unfortunately, that turned out to be a myth. And in reality, real estate prices in Japan declined and declined quite abruptly over the next 10 years. The second myth that I'd highlight comes from our experience earlier in the last decade with the dot-com companies. This myth was focused on the fact that we're supposed to have a revolutionary change in the model as a result of the internet in the way that companies were able to market to populations outside of their local markets. And as you can see in Figure 3, there was a very abrupt increase in dot-com firm stock prices. When I talked to many investors in and around the Boston area, I was assured that because there was such a change in financial markets, that we no longer had to focus on earnings or future earnings, but should be more focused on people's clicking of the mouse to get to various internet sites. Unfortunately, this too turned out to be a myth. As you can see, those prices quickly reversed over the course of the period around 2000 and 2001 and have remained quite low since. So those are just two examples where financial myths have played a very significant role. I would say in Japan, because it affected some of their largest financial institutions, the impact was quite severe, and some of the impact is still being felt today with Japanese real estate prices still quite low and Japan still facing a deflation. In the case of the internet bubble, it didn't have as large an impact because it was primarily an effect on stock prices, didn't affect our financial institutions and financial markets to the same degree. Let me turn to the role of financial myths in the recent crisis. So again, financial myths reflect the fact that investors assume that unlikely events are not going to occur and as a result behave as if recent trends and prices are likely to continue for various assets that have appreciated in a substantial way. So I'm going to focus on four myths. The first myth I'm going to look at is the myth that because real estate in the United States was increasingly becoming diversified through securities, that we didn't really have to worry about residential real estate price declines having a broader impact on the U.S. economy. Figure 5 shows you the movement of real estate prices in different parts of the country. It's a little bit like a spaghetti chart, and I apologize for that. But the main point that I want to show here is that even though some regions of the country were experiencing declines in real estate prices, others were experiencing very substantial price increases. So the idea was that if you had a diversified portfolio across the United States, that you were going to be insulated from the ups and downs in the various regional markets. And as figure six highlights, real estate prices had been growing over the last 30 years without an experience of a significant decline. But as figure seven shows, that turned out to be a myth as well, that real estate prices in the United States since the beginning of the financial crisis have actually had very substantial declines. The second myth that I want to focus on is whether AAA mortgage securities carried little risk. So as we started to get into 2005-2006, AAA securities were viewed as being relatively secure. It was thought because of their structure that even if real estate prices were to decline, and it was viewed as quite unlikely that they would, that the structures would at least protect the AAA securities holdings because any losses would affect the lower tranches of these various securitizations. As it turns out, that also turned out to be a myth. As you can see, a wide variety of AAA securities ended up selling at a very substantial discount, at least during some periods once the financial crisis occurred. It varied depending on the securitization, but as you can see, if somebody was forced to sell their securitization during the period of 2008, they would have expected to get very substantial losses. The third myth is tied to the originate-to-distribute model, which was that banks weren't taking much risk because they weren't holding things on their balance sheet. So the risks that were able to be dissipated because rather than holding it on their balance sheet, they would create securities and sell them into financial markets, and thus they would get a fee income, but they wouldn't have any exposure to the downside if the securities lost value. Unfortunately, many of these banks did hold parts of these securities elsewhere in the bank or held them in some off-balance sheet vehicles. When the off-balance sheet vehicles started getting into difficulty, many of the banks took these assets back on balance sheet, resulting in fairly large losses. So again, belief in the real estate values unlikely to go down, and the AAA securities provided some protection, meant that banks were much more comfortable with the so-called originate-to-distribute model. The final myth that I want to focus on is that investment banks were not subject to runs because their liabilities were collateralized. Now, we've had many protections for commercial banks potentially having runs, but the thought was that securities dealers in particular were going to be protected because they were collateralized when they were borrowing, so that they had securities called repurchase agreements that enabled the lender to be able to secure the collateral in the event that there was a problem at the firm. But as you can see, those lenders were much less willing to lend to dealers once the financial crisis occurred, because even though they were protected, they were still concerned about how well they were protected and were worried about the reputational risk and the legal risk associated with being able to actually collect on their collateral. So those are some examples of how financial myths contributed to the financial crisis. Now let me just talk briefly about whether we need to worry about financial myths going forward. So financial myths are reflecting the fact that there's overconfidence in recent historical experience, and there's an assumption that prices aren't going to decline as a result. One of the things that we've learned from this crisis is that we have to worry more about those unlikely events. We have to do a better job of understanding the assumptions that underlie our various financial models and ask ourselves what happens if prices do move in ways that they haven't done in recent history. Stress testing is a way of thinking about how unusual events can affect a balance sheet of a firm or can affect monetary policy, affect a wide variety of issues. And what it really is a structured way of thinking about unlikely events. I think it's very important that we do a much better job of that going forward, both as regulators, but also at the firm level as risk managers, CEOs, and board of directors, by outside evaluators such as rating agencies and stock analysts, and obviously bank regulators and regulators of financial institutions have to have more focus on this. Not only do we need to do the stress test, but they have to get a higher level of attention than they have in the past. So should we be at all worried about potential myths going forward? So myths are related to things that we don't think will happen, but could happen. And so I would just highlight two very briefly. One is that the sovereign debt problems will not be disruptive to the world economy. Again, the best guess is probably that even if we were to have more substantial sovereign debt problems, that we would be able to work through it without a major disruption. But as Figure 12 highlights, the spreads between the borrowing of some of the peripheral European countries and the spreads on German government bonds has gotten quite large. What this highlights is investors think there's a fairly high probability that in at least some of these countries there's a chance that they will have to restructure their debt. If that were to occur, there may be ways to do it that will not be disruptive, but we should at least think about the possibility that it could be disruptive. The second potential myth is state and local financing, which has certainly received a lot of attention recently. The assumption has been that it won't be disruptive to the national economy, and that indeed is probably the best bet. But nonetheless, I think it is important to think about what if the politics of some of the local and state financing result in more disruptions than people are currently anticipating. What kind of impacts could that have on our financial markets, and what kind of impacts could that have on our financial institutions? So worrying about financial myths is not saying that we shouldn't do things, it's saying that we should think about things. We should think about our underlying assumptions and be prepared to be able to take actions should some of our underlying assumptions turn out not to be accurate. Thank you very much.